So here we are with Dr. Adelaide Rundholz,
who is professor of foreign languages here at Johnson C. Smith University. And we're going to be chatting today about her latest collection. And I use the word collection here because we have the challenge of the fact that she is the editor of the book. She has a chapter in the book. She has work on the introduction and the not quite a conclusion in the book, which makes saying what she is actually attached to this book complicated, because it's a paragraph rather than saying that she's just an author. But the name of the book is Intercultural Dialogues and Identity in Lithuanian Literature. So Adelaide, thank you very much for coming on to this combined podcast and Mellon Learning Community broadcast, I guess we could call it. So thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So let's start out with the question of how you got involved in this project, because it's probably worth asking the question of how any scholar at an HBCU ends up working with people in Lithuania about Lithuanian literature, and this project with people from multiple locations dealing with multiple languages, even though it is published and accessible in English?
Well, good question. And the answer is, as so often, serendipity. Some years ago, probably in 2018, if I recall correctly, I had an opportunity to visit Kaunas and Vytautas Magnus University in the context of a conference, at which, by the way, I had nothing to do at all with Lithuanian literature. I was giving a presentation on zombies, quite a distance. And as often happens, you meet interesting colleagues at conferences, and I got into a conversation with my fellow editor, Professor Irina Ragasiene, and she asked me, would you be willing to work on a project with me? I'm not sure why she approached me, but I was happy to comply after I asked her what she had in mind. And what she had in mind was to put something together relating to Lithuanian literature in order to make it more known and more prominent beyond the borders of Lithuania. Because as you may be aware, in Kafka's terms, Lithuanian is one of the minor languages. There are like a couple million native speakers, and that's pretty much it. And this is maybe an item for later, but as we worked on this project, I discovered that there is really scandalously little being translated and known to, let's say, a speaker of English. In my book, that's wrongful neglect. And I speak this from the soul of a literature person. So after she approached me, we designed the general outline of the book, and then I was invited in the following couple years, I was invited twice to be a visiting professor at the same university in Kaunas, Vytautas Magnus University. And that assignment, or those assignments, had nothing whatsoever to do with Lithuanian literature, but everything to do with English, because my colleague is a professor in the English education program. So they're educating future English teachers. Serendipity.
And there's a surprising amount of that happens in scholarship. And this is something that the members of the learning community will be intimately familiar with, but our more general listener may not be. Where projects come along and are in some cases mutually discovered rather than fully strategically planned, so that you never quite know where the paths are going to take you. And that's one of the ways that not only scholarship is generated, but knowledge is generated. So with that in mind, what are some of the interesting things that you discovered about this, especially in terms of the learning community, which focuses on cultural studies? And you've got here in the title, and I'll spell it out more for our listeners, While it's intercultural, the inter is in parentheses there at the top. So what kind of dialogues about identity and interculturality did you see within this volume?
Well, one, I have to preface everything I'm saying by noting that as we launched into the project, I could not possibly have claimed any knowledge whatsoever regarding Lithuanian literature, because it is not widely disseminated due to lack of translations. Mm-hmm. There are some in German, and they're different from the very few that are available in English. But what really amazed me, not only as I found my own way into Lithuanian literature, but also by looking and editing the other contributions, it's an undescribably complex country. Mm-hmm. And there, the intercultural applies to the country itself. If I may, because I need to get the order right, let me just look at something here. So what is the complexity of Lithuania? Every country has its own convoluted history, if you will, but Lithuania seems to be downright labyrinthine. Where do we have? So we have a Grand Duchy and the first king Mindaugas in the 6th century. Later on, we have a dynastic union with Poland, after which follows the Commonwealth, in which Polish becomes the state language of Lithuania. Then comes absorption into Russia in 1795. 1918, Lithuania declared its independence and the Republic of Lithuania for the first time, only to then be occupied by the Germans and the Russians, respectively, during World War II. And of course, we know that Lithuania was hidden from view behind the Iron Curtain until the collapse of the Soviet Union. And in 1991, finally, Lithuania became part of the European Union. So it's just a smorgasbord of cultures. Vilnius, the capital city of Lithuania, has always housed a lot of different communities, including Poles, Jews, Germans, and of course Lithuanians. And there are a number of different cultures already present in the country and have been for hundreds of years, to the point where some Lithuanian writers, when I talked with my colleagues, like, my goodness, what is a Lithuanian writer if this person writes in Polish? Mm-hmm. Or subsequent to the end of World War II, a lot of Lithuanians were, of course, taken by the Russians to Siberia. There's great literature, by the way, dealing with that, and more recently even film. But you also have Lithuanians who migrated to places like the United States and Canada, and these days they don't write in Lithuanian either. Mm-hmm. They write in French, as we have one chapter in here. So what is a Lithuanian writer is by no means an easy question that begs a lot of different answers.
Mm-hmm. So do you see this in some ways as, because there are diasporic literatures, there's a long list of diasporic literatures in the world, you know, the Irish diaspora, certainly the African diaspora, mm-hmm. which is additionally complicated by the fact that you're looking at a continent's worth of people rather than, say, you know, I should have known better than to try to use French, the Ivory Coast or Senegalese or any of the other groups of people who end up being part of that wider diaspora into the world, whether it's in the United States with African American literature, the Francophone literatures that you find in all parts of the French-speaking world, whether it's Paris, whether it's the Caribbean. Is it that kind of a thing where you could parallel to those other diasporic literatures, or is it something that is much more unique and as a result both more simple and more difficult to speak about?
Well, how can I phrase my answer? It's very complex, but at the same time, diving into Metris Lithuanian has made me rethink the diasporas that you're referring to, because I feel as if the scholarship and the discourse that you can participate in at conferences and such venues perhaps lump identities together that ought to be separated, because you want to pay very specific attention to those. And here we can go back to the Côte d'Ivoire or Senegal or the Caribbean, because the African diaspora is, of course, a lot of different diasporas. Mm-hmm. And that's the conclusion I have come to. And there's no easy answer, and in our conclusion that is just sitting there in place of a conclusion, we are dealing with, they are available in English translation, because my Lithuanian is not nearly good enough yet to deal with the real thing, but we're dealing with an author who has written short stories, and three of those have been separated out, singled out for translation to English. And what's interesting about these three different stories, they're all perspectives on Vilnius, the capital city, except the narrators are very different in each one. One is a survivor of the Nazi occupation. Another one is actually a Nazi perpetrator. And the third one is a very elderly Jew who migrated during the war, lived in New York, and after many decades comes back to home. From these three narrators' perspectives, you have the impression you're dealing with three different cities. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of what I mean. Maybe this can serve as an example when I consider not a diaspora, but diasporas in the plural.
So we have a multi-layered, complicated identity then within the Lithuanian literature or literatures, whichever is going to be the more appropriate way to speak of it. Is it, and just kind of as full disclosure for the listening audience who may not be as familiar, my background is in Irish literature, hence my constantly reaching for it. But you had in the Celtic Revival / Irish Renaissance a real sense of a need to build or rebuild an identity in a way that the way that you were just talking about the capital city of Lithuania, perhaps you could look to James Joyce's Dubliners to see a similar kind of examining the city from a variety of viewpoints. All of them produce a much different looking city, which then, of course, changes as he revisits the city in later works. Is it that kind of an experience looking at either through your readings of Lithuanian literature and translation or through these essays where they are trying to form or rebuild a unified identity? Or is it a different kind of project that you think you're seeing within the literature that you talk about in this book?
I think it's a different kind of project. And this is going back to my colleague who felt compelled to do this project, mostly because there is, if we can say it like this, there's sort of a relatively recent crisis. Because when Lithuania became part of the European Union in 1991, everybody woke up. Say, okay, so who am I today? This is not unique, by the way, to Lithuania, but a lot of Europeans, as you're likely quite aware, are struggling with making the distinction between a national identity, if there is one to be had, and the larger entity that has imploded to include, what is it, 28 countries at this point, and all different languages, all different histories. So that's, in a sense, something that doesn't necessarily distinguish Lithuania from the rest of Europe. At the same time, the contributions and the things that I have found reading Lithuanian literature, there is something going on here that makes me say that we can probably safely put to bed Benedict Anderson's idea about the imagined community. It doesn't work, and it never applies in the literature that I have read, and that's in part what my chapter deals with, where a different writer, again of short stories that have been translated, dissociates nation from history and all the other items that Benedict Anderson names, flags, hymns, and whatnot, and she places the anchor of who I am as a person in meeting other people. So it's from person to person, mm-hmm. not something abstract, imagined.
Could you give the quick rundown of that theory for our listeners who have never heard of him?
Yes, Benedict Anderson is of fame. Now, I cannot for the world of me recall when he actually published this book. It's been quite a while. It's a slim volume titled The Imagined Community, and he is very much concerned with 18th century, 19th century developments in, I believe, England, Great Britain, where he associates the birth of the idea of nation with the advent of a mass public and newspapers. And it's through those media that everybody is socialized in similar ways and therefore can subscribe to a concept that can never be touched, but that has phenomena, tangible phenomena in the so-called real world, such as flags, such as national anthems, such as monuments, and so on and so forth.
So just through the magic of Wikipedia, which, as we all know, is never wrong, the book comes out in 1983, just to answer that question for you.
Thank you, yeah.
So we have then, in this collection, a number of scholars talking about these books. And just glancing through the table of contents, you can see some of the complexities in the very characters that show up on the page, so that I think it's in the conclusion you actually have Hebrew letters within the title of the not quite conclusion as well, along with if you just look through the typeface, of course, the echoes of much different languages. So it's all appearing in English, but you have the names of titles and authors very much using or attempting to use the alphabet an English speaker would be familiar with, but all sorts of little marks on it indicating pronunciations that we do not generally use in English. Did you, as you were working through this as an editor now, to a degree shift your hat away from the scholar, find that part of the process, well, I know that you did find it challenging, trying to translate across those linguistic and social cultural oddities, although oddities is probably not the right word. Can you talk about that a little bit in terms of the challenge? Because how many languages can you actively speak? Is it a dozen still? She's nodding her head for those of you who are listening along. And so that's a dozen active, and then there are others that you've got some familiarity with. So you approach these kinds of things from a much different viewpoint than myself, who is functional in one language and then barely functional perhaps in one other. So can you talk a little bit about that, both from a language point of view and from an editorial point of view, about negotiating those linguistic concerns within within your work here?
That's the big one. because obviously this is the portion of the work that consumed the most amount of time, since aside from myself, not another person in this volume is a native speaker of English. And now I had the privilege to be in Lithuania multiple times due to the conference and the visiting professorships. So my ear got used to hear the names and not make a total fool of myself when I try to pronounce them. But having said this, there were challenges because some of these contributors are not only not native speakers, they don't know English. So we had delays dealing with waiting for translators. The translators were third parties that I do not know. And whether or not they're scholars is not quite clear. So that was challenging and very time consuming. But then I have an advantage, although I will not claim to have great knowledge or proficiency in Lithuanian at this point. What I did discover is that Lithuanian and German, my native language, share commonalities. And unfortunately, one of those is that we are all very happy to make very long sentences. So much of the editing work was to tailor what the contributor was intending to say to the English-speaking reader. Who is from academic writing is expecting paragraphs, transitions, all these things that Europeans sometimes couldn't care less about. So fortunately, my editor has a very good grasp of English, although what she is familiar with is British English, so her spelling is of course totally different. Mm-hmm. As are many of the contributors, so it appears that they still, in Europe, like I did in school, we get exposed to British English. Mm-hmm. With all the colorful OU spellings and so on and so forth. But we never had really any friction based on these hurdles, and we tended to find good compromises. There were places along the way, obviously, when I was almost rewriting a contributor's portion. Of course, we double-checked with them, and in case I misinterpreted, we rectified this. So it was an ongoing back-and-forth process, working with drafts like we do, right?
Yeah, and it is one of the things that, for perhaps for our general readers, isn't always clear, because it's certainly not for our students. That sense, when you are first learning university-level writing, and especially scholarly writing, there is that editorial part where, yes, the ideas have to be yours, and in some ways the words have to be yours. But as Stephen King points out in his own book on writing, the editor is critical. And that may shift some of those words and some of that language. Mm-hmm. But so long as the initial thought, and in many ways the initial casting, is still attributable to the writer, that's perfectly fine and acceptable and expected, in a way that perhaps not everyone who gets a book in front of them is always fully aware, which is what makes, as you know, someone in your editorial role for this book, a real weighty responsibility in getting that out, so that you can make sure that the writer, which you are also in this book, is best shown, and that their ideas come across in the best way possible, in the most accessible way possible.
Yeah, and one great challenge I have discovered, but I had already known about, except I didn't anticipate it to become such a big deal, is the fact that in academic writing or scholarly writing for general readers, there are cultural differences. So it's not just the linguistic aspects. And like I said, here I was lucky because German and Lithuanian seem to be fairly similar in their love for long convoluted sentences with lots and lots of clauses. Sometimes I felt like I was reading Kant with my Lithuanian colleagues, but also each is embedded in a cultural context. The American reader expects clear language, clear introductions, which already anticipates conclusions, and then, like I mentioned before, must have transitions from one issue, one paragraph, to the next. That is not the case in many European contexts. The French never do that. They come out of the blue with something and go somewhere else in the stratosphere by the time they get to the end of an essay. Mm-hmm. Now, Germans and Lithuanians seem to be a little more organized, but they also will not spell out at the beginning where they're going to take the project because it's a journey. And mm-hmm. it's a discovery. So why would I pop the balloon and take away all the surprises if I can keep things entertaining? Something like this. Like I said, all of this comes under the heading that academic writing is dependent on the culture in which it is embedded. Mm-hmm. I would like to quote something because it deals with translation. It deals with crossing cultures. And it's from my essay in this book and from the writer who associates identity with the people she meets. And in one story, she says, the narrator notes that, quote, among all those whom I'd like to meet again, I'll also single out the man who translated Salinger into Lithuanian, unquote. Doing his work, quote, at a farmstead in a small village, unquote, the translator would try to rally the army of English words at his command, to force it, all of it, to desert their posts, to join up with his native language. Two worlds, nations, come together in the act of translation, rural Lithuania and metropolitan America, New York. And of course, the English and Lithuanian languages. As they come together, however, these worlds become entwined to the point that they cannot be separated anymore. Describing the complex work of translation and dealing with two structurally very different languages, the translator quotes, a great part of the moonlight would fall next to the barn and the barn door. I guarantee that if someone had written the very name of God on that door, it would be impossible to read because of the moonlight poured over it. Is being blinded by moonlight so that the name of God, were it written, cannot be seen, not akin to the inability to see the tree of nation, were it there, for the forest of its articulations and among the articulations the very number of nations. I do not know where this sentence came from. Is it mine or not? The answer is that it can only be both. The English sentence becomes Lithuanian. It started in the English language, and thus is Salinger's, but became Lithuanian by virtue of the work, knowledge, and choices on the part of the translator, and is thus his as well. So once it comes together, it cannot be picked apart again.
Mm-hmm. And that is one of the simultaneous pleasures and frustrations and challenges of any kind of a project like that, where you can begin as you encounter other languages and really begin to embed yourself in other languages, you can begin to, in the Irish language, the Irish poet Nuala McDonnell would talk about the Irish word blas, which means taste, and how she did not have the blas, the taste for English, sufficient for her to write poetry in English. and that she would had it in Irish, and that's where she would exclusively write. And no matter how beautiful her transliterations were, she didn't feel they were up to the task. So she would get her buddies like Seamus Heaney to go off and do the translation for her instead. And it is the kind of thing that opens the door and gives you a window into these other cultures and these other ideas. So for our audience then, if you were going to suggest to them the first step into Lithuanian literature available in translation, since this is an English-speaking podcast, we'll stick with the English-speaking works or the English translations. What are the ones that you would offer up as possible suggestions of places to start?
Well, since this book is also English-speaking, we're in luck. Well, the author I'm very, very fond of is Gidra Radvila Vijuta. So that's a mouthful. And it's taken from a book that is short stories, which is called Those Whom I Would Like to Meet Again. Then there are actually only two, believe it, only two. There's one edited or issued by Almanta Samalavičius, and it's called The Daedalus Book of Lithuanian Literature. It has sort of a smorgasbord of all kinds of items. And a second one by Laima Sruoginis, which is called Lithuania in Her Own Words, an anthology of contemporary Lithuanian writing, whereby contemporary is a stretch because this dates from 1997. And just by the way, Lithuania, like many cultures, the further east one goes, and here I would include Turkey, Persia, meaning Iran, and so on and so forth, prose is a relatively new phenomenon because these cultures really were very fond of their poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know about the intricate forms of poetry in the Arabic speaking world. Lithuania is no exception. Its main and dominant literary genre for centuries was poetry. And like in other places, especially in the 19th century, this is when you have the advent of prose, which has, of course, grown into a full-fledged adult at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, many of the authors, and this is part of what appeals to me now in hindsight, when it's all done, most of the contributors have produced their own translations, or the translators did the translations, of Lithuanian material that to date has not been translated. And part of the motivation for this volume is to hopefully inspire those translators out there to bring us more of Lithuanian matters.
Is there anything else that you want to leave our listeners with, both about your book project or the associated thoughts and ideas around it?
Well, what sticks in my mind is that if you launch into something that you've never been exposed to, like I had never been exposed to Lithuanian literature, mostly because you cannot easily find it in bookstores or online or whatnot, it's a wonderfully satisfying journey because you learn something, obviously, but what you're learning may make you rethink those loops that keep going through the brain in the same circles, and there are no surprises left. And one I have already mentioned is that I've begun to think quite differently about the notion of diaspora. In that I would hesitate anymore to even use that in the singular.
So this has been an interview with Dr. Adelaide Runholtz, professor of foreign languages here at Johnson C. Smith. Thank you very much again for being willing to sit down with us and to talk about your new book, congratulations about its release, along with your partner, who I will ask you, your co-editor, I will ask you to pronounce her name, because I'm sure I can get through the first part of the name, and then will immediately collapse once I get to her last name.
It's Irina Ragosina.
Okay. So thank you again, and thank you very much for listening.
Thank you for having me.